Hey everyone, and welcome back to the show. You're listening to Chaos Unplugged, the Yellow Journal podcast. I'm your host, Andy Jensen. I'm the past chair of the AAOS Resident Assembly and a current shoulder and elbow surgery fellow at the Mayo Clinic. On today's episode, we'll be reviewing three research articles from the November 15, 2019 issue of Yellow Journal, followed by an interview on approaches to total elbow arthroplasty. Our research articles this month explore the impact of patient-reported penicillin allergies on infections and total joint arthroplasty, compare patient-centered outcome measures in evaluating outcomes after ACDF surgery, and evaluate the effect of ligature use on blood volume and transfusion rates in sarcoma surgery. The titles of these three review articles are included in today's show notes. Afterward, I'll be joined by Dr. Gabe Horniff from the Rothman Institute in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to discuss the review article he and his co-author, Dr. Ramsey, wrote on surgical exposures for total elbow arthroplasty. In orthopedics, we talk a lot about approaches for hip arthroplasty and knee arthroplasty as well, but to some degree, the approaches for elbow arthroplasty has been overlooked. So our discussion is certainly an important refresher on the many different approaches and how to handle the triceps tendon while performing a total elbow arthroplasty. But before I get to all that with Dr. Horniff, let's first start with our three research articles this month. Up to 10 to 20% of the U.S. population report a penicillin allergy, but multiple studies have shown that 80 to up to 99% of these patients reporting penicillin allergies actually could have this label removed with the appropriate allergy testings. This becomes important in orthopedics because, as we all know, the understanding of patient allergies is important for preoperative planning and often can affect which preoperative antibiotics are administered. Cefazolin, which is also known as ANCEF, is the first-line recommended antibiotic for total joint arthroplasty according to the Surgical Care Improvement Project, or SCIP, guidelines. And despite the fact that only 2.5% of patients with a confirmed penicillin allergy also have confirmed cephalosporin allergy, oftentimes what happens is patients with penicillin allergy are given second-line antibiotics such as clindamycin or vancomycin in lieu of their ANCEF. It is not currently known in the arthroplasty population whether a self-reported allergy to penicillin has an effect on the rates of surgical site infection or if patients who ultimately receive second-line antibiotics have different rates of surgical site infections. With all this in mind, Dr. Stone and colleagues from Annapolis, Maryland, decided to perform a retrospective review of all hip and knee arthroplasty patients performed at their institution over a 2.5-year period to determine what the influence of a patient-reported penicillin allergy was on the rates of surgical site infection. They also secondarily looked at the influence of preoperative antibiotics, whether it was ANCEF, clindamycin, or vancomycin, on the rate of surgical site infection, and assess the rates of adverse reaction to antibiotics according to patient-reported allergies to penicillin. They had 4,903 patients who underwent primary hip or knee arthroplasty during this time, and 16% of them reported a penicillin allergy. These patients with penicillin allergies were much more likely to receive clindamycin or vancomycin instead of ANCEF. Of the nearly 5,000 patients who had a joint arthroplasty during this time, just 22 of them, or 0.5%, had a surgical site infection within 90 days. And the authors found that there was no significant influence on this rate of infections according to whether the patients did or did not have penicillin allergy, or whether they received ANCEF, clindamycin, or vancomycin. Interestingly, 55 patients who reported a penicillin allergy were given ANCEF perioperatively, and none of these patients experienced an allergic or adverse reaction to the medication. The authors summarized their findings by highlighting the importance and the distinction between a true allergic reaction to a medication versus simply an adverse event, and the importance of delabeling medication allergies in the electronic health record when appropriate. They conclude that they were unable to determine any significant effect of penicillin allergy reporting on the incidence of surgical site infection after hip and knee arthroplasty. Dysphagia, which is defined as a sensation of difficulty swallowing, and dysphonia, which is defined simply as disorder of voice, are the two most common postoperative complications following anterior cervical discectomy and fusion surgery. Despite these two being the most common complications after ACDF surgery, there is little agreement on how these symptoms should be monitored and what the true rates are, as evidenced by the fact that studies have found a rate of postoperative dysphagia between 3 and 67%, and other studies have found rates of postoperative dysphonia between 1 and 51%. Part of the difficulty in understanding the rates of these postoperative complications is a lack of valid and accurate assessment tools that clinicians and researchers can use to gauge the rates of these symptoms. With that in mind, Dr. Rosenthal and colleagues out of Northwestern University decided to study the validity and accuracy of two patient-reported outcome tools to assess postoperative dysphagia and dysphonia after ACDF surgery. The first tool is called the Eating Assessment Tool, or the EAT-10, which assesses rates of dysphagia. Previous studies have found scores greater than 3 are associated with clinically relevant dysphagia. The other assessment tool is called the Voice Handicap Index-10, or VHI-10, and this tool is used to measure clinically significant rates of dysphonia. Now, both of these tools have been used extensively in the ENT literature and have been shown to have excellent validity and reliability in their papers, but have not yet been used in ACDF patients. The authors administered these assessment tools to 100 consecutive patients at two different hospitals who underwent ACDF for 1, 2, or 3 levels. They administered the tools prior to surgery at postoperative day 1 and at 2, 6, 12 weeks, as well as 6 months and 1 year post-op. They found that both tools had excellent internal reliability, with the EAT-10 score of having an alpha 0.95 and the VHI-10 having an alpha of 0.90. They found indeed that clinically significant dysphagia, which of course can lead to aspiration pneumonia in postoperative patients, was in fact very frequent, with 83% of patients having an EAT-10 score greater than 3 on postoperative day 1. Clinically significant dysphonia was less common, with just 9% of patients reporting it on postoperative day 1. The authors concluded that both the EAT-10, which again is a score for assessing rates of dysphagia, and the VHI-10, which is a tool for assessing rates of dysphonia, are both easy to administer surveys that more accurately measure postoperative dysphagia and dysphonia in spine surgery patients than other currently used outcome measures. You may be familiar with the device called the ligature from your days on general surgery. Ligature is a handheld bipolar electrocautery device that also cuts tissue after providing hemostasis with an electrical burn. The device is typically used in laparoscopic surgeries, but there is a specific type of ligature called the ligature small jaw system, which has been used in certain open procedures such as thyroidectomies. A few case reports have described using ligature for sarcoma surgery, which tends, as we all know, to have particularly high blood loss. However, no study has assessed the effect of using ligature on sarcoma surgery. To that end, Dr. Levine and her colleagues performed a single institution retrospective study on patients who had had sarcoma resections over a 6-year period between July of 2010 and October of 2016. At their institution, in August of 2014, the ligature small jaw system was introduced and adopted, and thereafter their sarcoma patients were treated with the ligature as the primary hemostatic tool in addition to standard electrocautery. There were 91 patients who had sarcoma wide resections with just traditional electrocautery, and another 51 who had both ligature and traditional electrocautery. The authors assessed estimated intraoperative blood loss volumes as well as blood transfusion volumes for these patients. And additionally, they performed a case-matched analysis where they took 46 patients from the ligature group and matched them to 46 patients in the traditional electrocautery group based on sarcoma location and patient gender. What they found in the first analysis when they compared all patients who had had traditional electrocautery to all patients who had had ligature with electrocautery was that the estimated intraoperative blood loss decreased with the use of ligature from approximately 570 milliliters to 340 milliliters. And additionally, the volume of intraoperative blood transfusion decreased as well from approximately 450 milliliters to about 200 milliliters with ligature. When assessing just the matched groups, the statistically significant decrease in estimated intraoperative blood loss remained, but the decrease in blood transfusion volume was no longer statistically significant. The authors additionally found that there were no complications specific to the use of the ligature. The authors concluded by summarizing that ligature and the use of sarcoma surgery is safe and may be particularly useful in cases where there's extensive wide resections of tumors, such as during pelvic and sacral tumor surgery. All right, guys, and with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. John Gabe Horniff to the podcast today. Dr. Horniff, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Excellent. So we're going to talk today about your review article titled Surgical Exposures for Total Elbow Arthroplasty. But before we get into the paper itself, Dr. Horniff, can you tell our listeners a little bit about your background and where you did your training?
Sure. So I've been fortunate that most of my training has been pretty much in one city. I did medical school and residency at the University of Pennsylvania, and then traveled all but 20 city blocks to the Rothman Institute for my fellowship, where then I was fortunate enough to be hired, and I've been on staff there as an assistant professor of orthopedic surgery for the past 3 years.
Excellent. Of course, this is a particularly fun and special episode for me, not only because we're going to be talking about a shoulder-elbow topic, but one of the first experiences I had in orthopedics was as a medical student. I took call with you when you were a junior resident at Penn, and at least I had a great time doing it. So it's nice to come full circle a little bit and cross paths with you once again.
Yeah, it's amazing how much of a small world is. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah, it certainly is. So Dr. Horniff, what made you and your co-author, Dr. Ramsey, want to write this particular article?
So this article has actually probably been about 3 years in the making when I was a fellow with Dr. Ramsey. As you may or may not know, he's pretty well known in the world of elbow. When he came to the University of Pennsylvania, he was working with Jerry Williams and Joseph Iannotti, and they needed a guy to do elbow, so he did some training at Mayo. And now he ends up seeing a lot of people with elbow conditions, in particular elbow arthroplasty. And not only does he take on his own primary arthroplasties, but he also ends up doing a lot of revisions, either of his own cases or potentially of patients and seeing surgeons elsewhere.
Yeah, and it's a particularly important topic, I would say. I think in residency, we focus a lot on, you know, approaches of total hip arthroplasty and total knee arthroplasty as well. Don't really talk as much about the many approaches to total elbow arthroplasty, but there's a lot of variation and there's a lot of important differences that we'll get into a little bit today. So before getting to the operating room and you're proceeding with your total elbow arthroplasty, what sorts of thoughts are going through your mind about these different approaches and kind of the considerations in your head?
So I think, as any good surgeon would tell you, obviously preoperative planning is just as important as executing it in the operating room. I think the most important thing for all these patients, and whether it's just me and my young career or it's the right way to act, I think it's important to get some sort of 3D imaging whenever dealing with this kind of patient. In particular, when you're doing these for fractures, for patients with non-unions or malunions, it's really important to know where the different fracture lines are, where the different osteophyte formation may be, to really understand from a three-dimensional perspective what you're going to plan to encounter. I think the importance of knowing these different approaches really harkens back to the fact that, in general, total elbow arthroplasty hasn't had a great track record when you compare it to the world of knees and hips and even total shoulders, for that matter. As you can imagine, there's not a lot of soft tissue around the elbow opposed to these other joints. And for that reason, for patients who potentially are going to have to undergo a surgery more than once, you really want to be careful with that soft tissue sleeve as much as you can, because as you violate it each time, you're asking it to heal again. Patients can often have disaster cases where the triceps rips off or they've had multiple incisions in the skin and now they're looking at some sort of rotational flap or some sort of free flap to cover the elbow and potentially save their arm. So I think it's really important to know these approaches in deciding on how you're going to do it for each patient. when you do revision cases, I think the tricep splitting is very beneficial. It's much more of a straightforward approach. Allows you to do some things with the extensor mechanism that you might not be able to do with a reflecting or a sparing approach. And then there's other benefits of the sparing approach allowing you to maintain the extensor mechanism. God forbid if you ever had to go back in a second time. And then obviously the benefit of doing the reflecting approach is that you can get a really good view of your bony landmarks and make sure that you're able to instrumentate the best that you want.
So Dr. Horn, if your article starts off by talking about the different ways to position patients for total elbow arthroplasty in general, do you mind telling us some pearls you have and how you personally prefer to position your patients for total elbows?
Sure. So in general, there are two different ways you can approach the elbow when it's doing total elbow arthroplasty. And with patient positioning, there's some advantages and disadvantages to either way. The one preferred position that we use is supine, with the patient's arm draped across their body, using a bit of a bump over their chest. The other option is, of course, lateral decubitus, where you have the patient's arm draped over a arm holder, such as a paint roller. The advantage of the lateral decubitus position is that you don't necessarily need an assistant because the arm is sort of resting, whereas if you bring the arm across the body in a supine position, clearly while you're doing your approach, you're going to need somebody to hold the arm. So we'll usually have somebody positioned on the other side of the table to hold the arm for us. Both of them afford you pretty good access from the posterior aspect from the incision. I think the one advantage and the reason that we prefer the supine position is that when it comes time to instrument the patient's humerus or the ulna, as you can imagine, you're nowadays with the big push for the triceps on approach, and I know we'll talk about the different approaches, you really want to try to hyperflex the arm. And I feel that with the lateral decubitus position, it's often more difficult to do that. You often will have to sort of abduct the patient's shoulder away from their body, hyperflex the elbow at the same time, and then you find yourself not really having any sort of advantage with the arm holder anyway because you're sort of holding the arm off the arm holder. So in a pinch, I think the lateral decubitus position is certainly something you can consider, but the supine, I think, gains a little more access for when you're manipulating the arm.
I see. Do you alter your positioning at all if it's a revision situation, for instance, if you think you might need to use fluoroscopy?
Not necessarily. Just, I think the most important thing is when you're going to use fluoroscopy, always make sure you take your shots before you're completely prepped and draped. I think that kind of goes for any case that you're going to do whenever there's any sort of fracture concern, because a lot of times, if you're already draped out and you realize the C-arm is a smaller C-arm and might not reach to where you want it to go, you'll be kicking yourself later because you might have to take down all the drapes. I think usually with our approach, if we do supine, we'll bring the bed 90 degrees, turn 90 degrees from the anesthesiologist, and then bring the C-arm usually from the head of the bed on the same side. Allows the radiology technician to come in and come out from the head of the bed. If you have a big enough C-arm, you could certainly go across the table. But when you consider that you're going to end up needing to extend the elbow, now you're going even further across the table. I think it's easier to come from the head of the bed.
Gotcha. You mentioned anesthesiologists. What type of anesthesia do you use for these cases? And in particular, do you utilize a preoperative peripheral nerve block?
So all the patients that we do get general endotracheal intubation. We do often do preoperative blocks for the shoulder patients. I personally, for the elbow patients, because of the close proximity of the median, ulnar, and radial nerve, the fact that you're dissecting these things off and manipulating the arm much more than you do for, say, a shoulder case, I personally do the block postoperatively. It's usually an interscalene block for these patients. They typically get a single shot block. I like to make sure that once the patient is taken to the recovery room, can assess all their motor and sensory function, which with the anesthesia on board, you might have to wait a few minutes. I know that the anesthesiologists don't seem to mind because it also makes sure that if, God forbid, there's some sort of neurological injury, there's no pointing of fingers and blaming, well, who was responsible for it.
Yeah, certainly clarifies the situation. Okay, so you have your patient positioned in the supine position. You're going to do your postoperative nerve block. As your paper discusses, there's three general methods of managing the triceps tendon during your approach for your total elbow. Dr. Murf, do you mind taking us through what these three categories are and what are some considerations you have when thinking about what approach you're going to use?
Sure. So the three general categories that we decided to break up in the paper were triceps splitting, triceps reflecting, and the more commonly used nowadays, the triceps sparing approach. In all three cases, the approach, as you can imagine, coming from the triceps starts off posteriorly. One of the big concerns that you have with total elbow arthroplasty is that it's not as robust when you look at it historically compared to total knees and total hips, in addition to infection and aseptic loosening. The biggest concern with the elbow in particular is whether the extensor mechanism remains intact. So traditionally, tricep splitting approaches were used. They have kind of fallen more to the wayside, I would say, for revision cases when there's much more scar, much more concern for possibility of adhesions, potentially even having to lengthen the triceps, and we can talk a little bit more about that in detail. The triceps reflecting is the very common Brian Mori approach that was described up at the Mayo Clinic. It is the common one that you'll see when you look at the technique guides for a lot of the total elbow arthroplasty companies. And then more recently, the tricep sparing approach has come into play because it allows us to really prevent the chance of rupturing that extensor mechanism. I think it's really important nowadays. We're seeing more and more patients who are not necessarily the older rheumatoid patient who is low functional demand with the use of their arm. And since we're putting these in patients who potentially have fractures, may even be younger, there's a stronger chance for revision surgery and having to disrupt that extensor mechanism potentially twice. If you can avoid that with a tricep sparing approach, I think it's advantageous. But that's generally the three categories that we talked about in the paper.
Interesting. Okay, so if you're going to use a tricep splitting approach, what are the advantages and disadvantages that you see?
So we typically, with the tricep splitting approach, we'll use it in revision cases. Very often, as with all these approaches, we'll start off with a posterior incision just off the medial aspect of the olecranon. The reason that we do that is to prevent any chance of a scar formation over the tip of the elbow where the patient can end up leaning on it. Some surgeons prefer to go a little bit lateral to the olecranon. The reason that we tend to go medial is because very often the ulna is obviously more on the medial side. And when you're instrumenting the humerus and the ulna from that side, it's usually easier to have the skin incision over that side. With the tricep splitting approach, the traditional Campbell approach, which was basically the initial approach described for the elbow, pretty much go right down the center of the triceps. And as you come down, you sort of have to shell off the triceps insertion, both medial and laterally, as you split it down. The advantage of this is that it's obviously a straightforward approach, and there's very little chance of deviating from the midline to injure any of the nerves, with most concern being around the ulnar nerve. You can basically envelop that within its own deep tissue pocket. The disadvantage of this is, as you can imagine, by splitting the triceps, you're inciting a lot of scar formation that could become adherent to the posterior aspect of the humerus. In addition, you're now splitting the triceps and peeling it off if it's a footprint. So you have to make sure you have a really robust repair with that. And for patients who you essentially want to get moving quickly, you have concerns about this tearing off. So what we very often do at the Rothman Institute now is we'll use this approach more or less for revision cases. And in addition to that, we typically go towards the Van Goiter tricep splitting approach, where we actually take the aponeuroses of the triceps, split the triceps proximally, and then reflect the aponeuroses sort of distally. If you look in the paper, you can see a nice figure of that showing the tongue of the aponeuroses kind of flipping down. And as you peel that back, you basically have dissociated the ulna and the humerus from each other. The nice advantage of this is that when you go to repair things at the end, if the patient has some sort of contracture, you can gain a little length out of the triceps tendon. And that's typically the only time that we use it.
Understood. So mostly in the revision setting. And I just like to echo what Dr. Hornev said. The figures 11 through 15 are really excellent drawings, really well illustrating exactly what we're talking about today. So I'd encourage all the listeners to check them out. So how about for the triceps reflecting? What are your thoughts on the advantages and disadvantages there?
So when I first started doing total elbow arthroplasty in my residency, the doctors that I trained with typically did the triceps reflecting approach. I think this is the most utilized approach, even to this day, described in 1982. It's the one that when you look at the Coonrad-Mori, which is the most commonly used linked prosthesis in the United States, it shows that description of that technique. The advantage of this technique, bar none, as opposed to the triceps on approach, is the fact that by taking off the entire triceps from its footprint, you get access to the ulnar canal and to the humerus that you certainly couldn't get, even in the best of situations, with keeping the triceps on. By reflecting everything as one large soft tissue sleeve, you're able to completely move it from medial to lateral. And I think it's really important when it comes time to instrument the ulna. As you know, the ulna is a very thin bone, has a little bit of a curve to it, so you don't have a lot of play or wiggle room if you can't really get a good sight down the axial pipeline, so to speak. So I think it's really helpful in that regard. The downside to it, obviously, again, is you're taking the triceps off. The concern with that is that with these patients, to get them moving quickly, just like in the sitting of any sort of tendon repair, whether it's triceps or rotator cuff or biceps, you have to sort of depend on the integrity of your repair. So it's really important that you get a good, robust repair before letting patients do what they want to do. In our institution, we typically do the transosseous repair, which is also what was traditionally described, with two cruciate tunnels and then a transverse tunnel, crack house stitching on both the medial and lateral aspect of the tendon, and then bringing it through the tunnels and tying it. Two of the disadvantages of that are, one, if you take too big of a bite with your crack house stitches, you can start to bunch up the tendon, which can also cause a little bit of a contracture. And then I think the other disadvantage that I've seen in patients is that often you want to use a heavy non-absorbable suture to make sure that you're getting a good integrity of repair. But sometimes in patients who are a little bit thinner, perhaps older, with less thick, soft tissues, they can actually feel the knot subcutaneously. So it's really important that you bury your knots in this situation. But when it comes to visualization, and I think for surgeons who don't typically do these procedures, they really want to make sure that they're getting the implants in the most important position, I think by far it's the most reliable approach.
For these approaches where you have to violate the triceps insertion onto the olecranon, does that change your postoperative management?
For me, it does. I should say that all my patients, during that initial 10 to 14 days, I pretty much just put them in a splint at about 30 degrees of flexion. It's a little bit inconvenient for them because they're not really able to put their arm entirely in a sling. But I think it's important to sort of keep the arm a little bit relatively extended to take some load off the triceps. For the patients who have had the triceps removed, when I see them at their first postoperative visit, I'll let them start doing some active assisted range of motion, usually going from about 0 to 90 degrees for 2 weeks, then up to 105 degrees, then up to 120 degrees at 2 week intervals. With the patients who keep the triceps on, I'm a little bit more comfortable with them bending a little bit more. So I still will let them do active assisted range of motion and passive range of motion, but I'll let the trajectory of their range of motion proceed a little bit faster.
All right. And for the last group, the tricep sparing group, do you mind telling us a little bit about when you choose this approach and what are the pros and cons?
Sure. So as I mentioned before, this is our kind of our go-to approach nowadays. The nice thing and the biggest advantage of this is that you don't disrupt the extensor mechanism entirely. You allow the triceps to remain on its footprint, which bypasses the concern for extensor mechanism failure. As I mentioned before, with patients being younger and having this done with more activity demand, you are worried about them potentially wearing out the implant or wearing out their repair of the triceps. So this basically hopes to get rid of that concern. The approach starts off just as the other ones have, starting off with an incision straight off the posterior aspect of the elbow, just deviated a little bit off the olecranon tip. On this approach, we typically will find the ulnar nerve, as we do with the other approaches. I usually tag it with a vessel loop and build a subcutaneous pocket to put it anteriorly. And then really what this comes down to is making two windows along the triceps that allows you to place either the humerus or the ulna through. The lateral window, usually what we'll do is we'll start on the subcutaneous border of the ulna, leaving a little bit of fascial layer attached, and then peeling down the anconeus laterally and continuing that up along the lateral aspect of the olecranon and typically taking a straight shot up to the triceps. In this lateral side, you do split down the triceps tendon a little bit, leaving a little bit of a tendon edge on either side, and that's really important for when it comes to the repair. I think the same thing holds true for when you're taking the tendon and the muscle bellies off the ulna. You want to make sure you leave a little portion of tendon attached to the subcutaneous border so you can repair it at the end. So this ends up being your larger window. On the medial side, I found that once you move the ulnar nerve out of the way medially and you take the floor of the cubital tunnel, you can take it proximally along the medial border of the olecranon, continue that up through the triceps, right around where it meets with the intermuscular septum, and then distally taking down the FCU carefully along the ulna, again, leaving a small portion of tendon to attach to at the end. I think this window doesn't necessarily have to be as big. I very often will try to utilize the lateral window for my humerus and my ulna as much as possible because I feel that it keeps the ulnar nerve in a safe place. Sometimes you might have to bring the ulna out through the medial window, but very often you're able to do it laterally. I think the most important thing is that you're hypersupinating when you're doing this to really try to gain exposure. And the disadvantage, obviously, compared to a triceps reflecting approach is that you are fighting the triceps a little bit. So very often where the olecranon starts to sort of curl up in the posterior aspect around the posterior portion of the trochlea, you'll have to take a rondure or a burr and burr this down so you can kind of get a better view of the ulnar canal. And it can be a little disorienting and you can be a little bit concerned. I think the most important thing is going slow with it. Don't be afraid to use a significant amount of suction and irrigation as you're making your canal down the ulna, especially to make sure that you're not deviating too far into the cortical bone. But if you take your time, I think you can get just as good of an outcome as far as positioning of your implants, and then obviously the added benefit of not taking down the extensor mechanism.
Are there any patients in your practice who, even in the primary total elbow setting, you will not utilize the sparing, tricep sparing approach?
If patients have pretty significant deformity, I had one gentleman that comes to mind who had a really bad distal humeral malunion, and basically he had splayed out both of his condyles so much that even with trying to do the tricep sparing approach, the issue was that his condyles were so large and spread out that I really couldn't safely get the humerus through either window. So I ended up opting to do a triceps reflecting approach. It's not the end of the world if you have to do it. Like I said, it just has to slow you down, your recovery a little bit. For a patient like that, I was a little more comfortable doing it. And potentially for bigger patients, sometimes I think it can be an issue, especially if someone's a little more muscular. But the truth is, the majority of these patients who are getting this procedure tend to be frail, older, and usually have a skinnier arm. I think it's very, very rare that you're doing this in indicated any patient who's under the age of 60, not to say that they aren't out there, but for the most part, they still fit the profile of the older female patient who gets this procedure done.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Horniff, for that excellent overview of approaches for total elbow arthroplasty. And again, I would encourage all the listeners to check out his and Dr. Ramsey's article in this month's Yale Journal titled Surgical Exposures for Total Elbow Arthroplasty. Dr. Horniff, before you get out of here, can you leave us with two take-home points that you'd like us to remember from your paper and from our conversation today?
Sure. I think the most important thing is be able to understand these different approaches and what they can gain you and where they're going to also potentially cause you trouble. If it's not a procedure that you often do, sometimes it's best to just forego worrying about keeping the extensor mechanism intact and really making sure that you're affording yourself the best chance of getting a good seating of your implants. So don't be afraid to do the reflecting approach. I don't think it's the end of the world if you decide to take the triceps off. I think the second most important point I would have is really make sure that you've done a good job of positioning your patient appropriately. If you have the proper help in the room, I would recommend the supine approach, holding the arm across the body. If you don't, and you're going to use lateral decubitus position with some sort of arm holder, just make sure that you think you can get the instrumentation the way you want, putting the arm in the position that you'd like. If you have to use a C-arm, it's really important that you take your views with your C-arm fluoroscopy before you start the procedure, just to make sure that you're not scrambling once the patient's already been prepped out. It's the old adage of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and I think it kind of goes the same way for the operating room.
Awesome. Well, thanks for taking your time today, Dr. Horniff.
No problem. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
All right, team, so that will do it for today's edition of JOS Unplugged, brought to you by the AAOS Resident Assembly. I want to thank you all for listening. Hopefully you enjoyed it as much as I have and continue to find this podcast educational. You can find Dr. Horniff's review article, as well as the three research articles we discussed today, in the November 15, 2019 edition of JOS. If you haven't already, please rate and review this podcast on your audio player of choice and spread the word to anyone else who's interested in learning more about orthopedics. And with that, I'm Andy Jensen, and I'll see you next time.